It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. For nearly a year now, WESA has brought you the Dinner Party Download on Fridays at 9 p.m. The Dinner Party has been described as a fast and funny booster shot of news and culture designed to help you dazzle your friends and family at this weekend's dinner party. The show is the creation of Brendan Francis Noonan and my next guest, Pittsburgh native Rico Galliano, co-host and co-producer of the show. Along with Noonan, Mr. Galliano was named one of Food and Wine magazine's Big Food Thinkers 40 and Under and appeared as a guest judge on the Bravo TV shows Top Chef Masters and Rocco's Dinner Party. He's a proud Pitt graduate, and he's back in Pittsburgh joining us in Studio A. Rico Galliano, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me again. I must have done great the last time.
Yeah, well, it's been a couple times, but this is the first time in person. You're sitting here, you're in Pittsburgh. What is it like to
be... You have a beard. I didn't know that.
Yes, I do. And it looks like you're trying to grow one. Is this for the playoffs?
Oh, I'm always trying.
Okay.
I'll never succeed, unfortunately. Thanks, Mom and Dad, for those jeans.
Well, you are, in fact, from Pittsburgh. You're back in Pittsburgh. So, you know, when you spend most of your time in L.A., what kind of decompression do you go through when you come back here, or recompression?
Oh, that's interesting. Almost immediately, my mother feeds me her special shrimp dish, and that helps decompress mightily. I usually sleep because I usually take a red eye in the middle of the day. I guess there's that. There's always, I feel like the thing that I do when I come back to Pittsburgh is there are sort of boxes I have to check of stuff I have to eat. That's the most important thing.
Like?
Well, Primanti sandwich, obviously, is important. An Uncle Sam sub, just so that I don't leave them out, all of the different types of meat sandwiches in Pittsburgh. I try to get a pierogi somewhere, and it's usually the Church Brew Works, I would say. I think, does Bloomfield Bridge Tavern still have those amazing pierogies, do you know?
Oh, yes, okay. They do.
And maybe I'll hit them up this time. I'm coming, you guys. So start frying up them onions.
Carving up.
There's a lot of carving up that happens in Pittsburgh.
They don't eat like this in L.A., do they?
You know, that is a myth about L.A., that people like are all eating health food.
There's two beans and a leaf? No, that's not true?
No. L.A. is a taco town. L.A. is the home of the food truck explosion sort of began in Los Angeles. The Kogi food truck, which sort of fused Korean barbecue with tacos. And that is not light fare, my friend. That is some sweet, sugary, delightful meats on a piece of starch. So don't worry about us. We just exercise.
Yes,
is the difference.
Well, we do that here. You're going to see a lot of people jogging and biking, which brings me to my next question, which is, how has Pittsburgh changed over the years?
Is that a general enough question for you?
Well,
what
you know, you don't have to mention all of the changes, but I'm guessing there's some really interesting ones that are just going to hit people right over the head.
Actually, I will say about the food culture here, it is interesting that I remember there was a time shortly before I left in 1995 where I went to a diner on the South Side, and I can't remember which diner it was, but they had like a light menu. Like, you know, a little section of the menu for light fare. And one of the first items on it was a deep fried ball of dough.
That's the light menu?
Yeah, it didn't have meat in it. So that was the light fare. Now, I saw a guy last night who tells me there's a pizza joint in Garfield that has like vegan buffalo wings and things like that. That was unheard of when I was living here. So that's certainly something that has changed, is that I think you can actually eat healthily here. There was like, I think when I left here, there was maybe one sushi joint in the entire place, which is certainly not the case anymore. So foods, I guess, is one thing. What's another thing? I mean, I remember the most visceral thing for me was when the Southside Steel Mill became the Southside Works.
Jones and Lachlan. Yeah,
is that what it was?
Yeah, it was Jones and Lachlan, and you'd be on the parkway, and you'd look down, and you'd see all the smoke and the flames, that was such a part of this area. Yeah, that is
sure.
That is gone.
Oh,
now they're shopping there.
That's right. And I mean, for a long time, it was just a hull, obviously, when I was, you know, they shut it down and then it just sat there for a very long time. And that can't be allowed to happen. You can't have a big death trap sitting on prime real estate by the river for forever. But I remember going there when they changed it and it became Urban Outfitters and all that stuff and being like, really, this is what they're going to replace the steel mills with? Is you know, there's an Urban Outfitters three blocks away from my house in Los Angeles. So that was a little bit of a weirdness there. I had hoped that there would be maybe more local stuff growing up over there. That was interesting to me.
what else is really?
You grew up in Mount Lebanon.
Right? Yeah. And went to high school there and then went to college at Pitt.
So describe those years, because you also spent some time in Squirrel Hill. Was that the Pitt years?
Yes.
Okay.
Indeed.
So
Squirrel Cage. Yeah. That's where I went to school, really.
Right.
Is what it feels like.
Yes. Well, I'm probably plenty of people who can say that.
Yes.
Describe growing up in Pittsburgh. It's a you know, unique city, I'm curious how it has impacted you and your art.
As a radio, I was a radio guy at WPTS at Pitt,
sure.
And that absolutely is one of the reasons why I stayed in radio when I went to LA. Well, I wanted to get back into radio anyway. I moved out there to actually work in television, but yeah, that was incredibly influential on me. Kind of I had a weekly show on that station, and I had one of the few shows. WPTS was unlike, say, WRCT at Carnegie Mellon in that it was actually a little more programmed. It wasn't totally freeform, so you had to sort of follow some rules. Mm-hmm. But I was lucky in that I got an all-request show because I had a show on Saturday nights, and to lure me into giving up my Saturday nights, they made it all-request, and I could play anything that I wanted.
What were you playing?
Oh, man, that was definitely the alternative. I used
like,
to say I would
you
play
know,
anything.
Joy Division from the late 70s?
Indeed,
okay.
That stuff,
great
R.E.M.,
stuff.
Of mm-hmm. course. Joe Jackson was a big favorite of mine. I remember that I used to say that I would play anything except the song Bitchin' Camaro by the Dead Milkmen.
I remember
because
that.
I would get requests for that every damn second. And I just, you know, come on, guys. There's other, even that band has other songs, for real.
But you were studying screenwriting, yeah. And then
Film studies.
Film studies,
and then I went to LA to study screenwriting.
Okay, so you were looking, you were on the path to a career in film, but it sounds like you're doing more on the radio.
Oh yeah, it's the most ironic thing ever.
Is that a happy little accident, or?
Yeah, I think so. It's the thing that I like about radio compared to film is I feel like radio. Well, it's not compared to film, but the thing I like about radio is that it takes in a whole bunch of different things. There's a performative aspect. Although we are not scripted right now, we are modulating our voices for the audience. It's a little bit of a performance.
Yes, we are, Rico.
Wow. That sounded good. there's writing that you can do. There's production that's involved. I don't know. I think the difference between film and radio, too, is that there's a constant deadline in radio, and I'm just lazy enough that I need to have the kick in the pants to constantly be producing stuff, frankly.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA, and my guest is Pittsburgh native Rico Galliano, host of the Dinner Party Download, heard Friday nights at 9 on WESA. You worked for Marketplace, filing stories from England and Ireland, the Netherlands, Sweden, South Korea, and India. I'm reading the stickers off of your suitcase here. So do you miss the life of a globetrotting foreign correspondent?
A little bit. There's definitely times when I miss it, for sure. Although it is the way that those things were planned is really interesting. You know, I'd go in for 2 weeks. And this is public radio. It's not like I had a fabulous budget and was staying at the Four Seasons. It was, you know, $1,000 to stay for 2 weeks in some foreign land. So you'd spend a long time researching what stories I was going to cover in those 2 weeks. And while that was really cool, like touching down and then just having to get to work and run around interviewing all of these people, I remember the problem with that was that you'd get to one of these countries that you'd researched, get there, find out all sorts of additional things that were amazing, but you didn't have time to report on any of that stuff. You could only report on the stuff you'd already researched. I always felt by the time I left a country, I had enough of an understanding of it to do a better job reporting on it, which is why I think, in general, I wish that there were more foreign bureaus that would be out there where people actually live in those countries and really get to know those countries. But there are fewer and fewer of those, which is why I love the New York Times, for instance, because they actually still have some of those bureaus and people implanted there. NPR, of course, has Cynthia Pujoli. That's why you can always count on her getting the best stories out of Italy, because she's there, you know. So if you want to base me in, say, Amsterdam for a few years, that would be awesome. Can you make that happen?
I'll see what I can do. I'll talk to NPR. But that is the lament of journalists, and that is what some people see as a problem.
Hmm.
Was that something discouraging to you? And with the decreasing emphasis on foreign coverage?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think that's disappointing to a lot of people in media. I don't want to, you know, whine too much about the fact that I got to travel on somebody else's time for a couple of years and see. You know, I went to the Taj Mahal on, you know, one of my reporting trips, and that was spectacular. That's the place on earth I most wanted to go to. But I do think that that is the lament of media in general, is that there's not, you know, you see staffs cut and cut and cut and cut. It's not just that each reporter has to do more work. It's that you're losing whole areas of coverage invariably. Because you need, I feel like it's great to have reporters that have expertise in what they're doing. I think more and more people are being generalists because they have to. They have to cover a lot of different beats. Whatever.
So at what point did you kind of assess your career and your goals and say, okay, I want to create this show that's a big dinner party, and I have guests over, and it's kind of like they're coming to my house, and we talk and visit and that kind of thing.
How did it come about?
Yeah.
It was me and my co-host, Brendan. By the way, I give you props for pronouncing Brendan Francis Newnham correctly. Everybody wants to say Newman. It's hilarious because they tend to get my name correctly, Galliano, which has a silent G in it. But they always screw up his name because it looks like a trick.
So if he crosses you up, do you sit there going, Newnham?
That's, yes. Newnham! But what was the question again? Oh, yeah.
How did you come up with this silly show? Yeah.
I was working on Marketplace. Which, you know, I had this theory that people move to L.A. and get hooked up with the last job on earth they should ever do. It's like I was a big fan of sort of subcultures and movies and edgy independent cinema, and I was covering on Marketplace, you know, the markets, which didn't seem like the right fit, although I had a great time doing it. And so I'm sitting there wanting to cover more of the stuff that I studied, the arts, et cetera, culture, things that I was interested in. And Brendan was a producer also at Marketplace of a sort. And we were having the same lament, and what would be the show that we would want to do? And it would be a show where we got to talk about all of these different things. But, you know, two guys that have a show where they talk about the arts didn't seem quite enough. And we kept talking about, I just want to have the kind of show that's all the stuff I would talk about at a dinner party. And we said, why don't we make the show like a dinner party? It will be a representation of a dinner party. So that gave us the kind of structure of the show. And I will definitely admit that that was hatched over some beers.
And this was how long ago?
Like 4 years ago. It started as a podcast, just a 15-minute podcast. The idea was that you could actually listen to it on your way to a dinner party. And by the time you got there, you'd have enough trivia to carry you through the party if you hadn't had a chance to, say, read the newspaper that week or something. But it began as a podcast and got quite popular. And our, you know, overlords at American Public Media took note and decided to sort of give us enough breathing room to turn it into a full radio show. And here we are.
And here you are. And the guest list of the people that you have on your shows is amazing.
Thank you.
You haven't been around that long. I mean, 4 years in radio is really not terribly long. But you have...
Feels like it.
Well,
I feel like I'm 100 now.
You don't look it.
Thanks.
In fact, in person, you look much younger than you sound. I hope that's okay to say.
That is fine.
I'm not giving away anything. But you have Colin Firth on the show, Bryan Cranston. Your show with James Franco just ran last Friday. How are you able to attract all of these A-listers?
I don't. For one thing, I think that they, over the course of time, they trust us now. It wasn't an easy thing to start getting celebrities on a show that nobody had ever heard of. But once a few people started doing it and they have a good time, that's, I think, the main thing. When they come out of our show, they always say, that was really fun. Especially the guests that we get is, say, we have an etiquette segment where celebrities answer listeners' etiquette questions. And we've had, like, a great example of this is Bobby Flay came on recently. And his publicist, I think, was really into our show. I doubt that he'd ever actually heard it. And he came in, and I don't think – he was like, what is this? He came into our New York bureau, which is kind of a little bit of a rinky-dink bureau. And I think he was, you know, not thinking that we were maybe a sham of some kind. He had just come from being on the Today Show, you know. And by the end of that thing, he was so obviously loosened up and was having a great time answering people's questions about how to inure themselves to hot peppers and things like that. They always seem to leave the studio like, that was really fun. And I think the more that word gets around, the more people are willing to come on. Also, we have a guy named Jackson Musker, who's our assistant producer, that does nothing but cajole publicists all day long. And I sit next to him, and that guy is a genius.
Who was a difficult interview for you?
Oh, Julian, I'm going to forget his last name, the lead singer and songwriter, one of the lead songwriters for The Strokes. And he was trying. The problem with Julian, he used to have a real problem with alcohol, and he's kicked it since, and he came out with a solo album. And you could tell that he was trying not to be the kind of notorious jerk to an interviewer that he had been in the past, but it just is not in him. Like, there was a point where I asked him a question and he was actually sighing as he answered it, like, "Oh, right, I guess I have to answer this question." I'm like, "You're on the radio. I can't just quote you. You have to sound like you're excited about being here." That was a problem. If you go and look at Neil Strauss, the Rolling Stone interviewer's book, I can't remember the name of it right now, but the first chapter is called The Worst Interview I Ever Did, and Julian is the very first interview in that chapter. So apparently this is universal.
Well, when something like that happens, if you have a guest who just isn't engaged or is giving you a hard time for one reason or another, what do you do?
I don't know. I mean, the nice thing about our show is that we have these two questions that we ask everybody, all of our like main guests on the show, and it's kind of for this reason. And they're designed to sort of throw them off their game a little bit. The first one being, tell us the question that you're sick of being asked, which gives them a chance to, if they're people that are just in a bad mood that day, they get to rant about, yeah, I'm sick of this. People are always asking me the same questions. And the other thing is to tell us something we don't know that will blow our minds at a dinner party, and it doesn't have to have anything to do with their lives. And it's surprising how often they will kind of wake up. It throws them off the typical celebrity script for whatever they're promoting.
That they've said 100 times
exactly.
By the time they get to you.
Sure. So we have people like, I'm trying to give the best example of this. We had, what is her name? Angelica Houston telling us the color of her underwear. You know, this is not something that Angelica is used to talking about. We had Molly Ringwald told us that she could bark like a dog really super realistically, which is my favorite piece of tape we've ever had on the show because she really can.
Really?
Yes.
That would have been – I missed that episode.
I'll send it to you.
By the way, the Strokes lead singer, Julian Casablancas.
Casablancas. Yes. Great name, by the way.
Yeah. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA, and my guest is Pittsburgh native Rico Galliano, host of the Dinner Party Download, heard Friday nights at 9 on WESA. So have you had people say – after listening to your show, Rico, I was the hit of the dinner party I attended last weekend. I used everything you talked about. I dropped all of these names and information, and people just flocked to me.
I haven't gotten quite that level, but I have. My favorite is people who listen to the show, and they know somebody who doesn't admit to being a listener to the show, but we start every show with a joke.
Right.
And these friends will invariably, sometime around when the show airs, they'll come around and tell a joke, this great joke. They're always full of jokes, and they're always the jokes that have been on their show. And an etiquette question that has been asked on our show is, what do I do if I know that my friend is getting all their jokes from your show? And they're completely unoriginal jerks because they're not owning up to the fact that they're getting it from your show. How do I politely address that question? And we've never actually asked it because I kind of like the fact that that tension exists in the world.
As far as you're concerned, what are the essential ingredients of the perfect dinner party?
People always ask us this. It's like,
you're doing to me what the guests on your show do to you.
Yeah,
like, I've already asked this. Answered this 100 times.
This would be the question I least like
being asked. Yeah, exactly.
Not
I should have just phrased it that way.
That's true.
What is the question that you least like being asked,
well,
Rico?
Let me tell you. It has to do with these dinner party things. It's my fault for like structuring a show that way. But the thing of the show is that it's really a show about arts and culture that's structured around a dinner party. We're not ambassadors of like dinner party. Like, I don't know what side the fork and the knife should go on. But I will say the something that we've kind of talked about, myself and my co-host, is that it's a nice combination of comité. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Kind of, you know, friendliness and comfortableness combined with a little bit of friction, like coming up with some sort of something that there's a little bit of tension over, but not too much tension. Like the ideal conversation topic, something on our show is that my co-host hates cupcakes, and there's been this huge cupcake explosion, and nothing has delighted our listeners more than hearing him argue with various people about why cupcakes should be banished off the face of the earth. That seems to me like the kind of ideal dinner party thing because people get really passionate about that. People really love cupcakes or they really hate cupcakes and find them the bane of the earth.
So serving them will create all kinds of tension.
There you go. Serve cupcakes, ladies and gentlemen.
As with all dinner parties, no matter how good they are, they all have to end sometime.
Alas.
How long do you see your dinner party lasting?
Forever. What? I would. I would love to do this for as long as we could last. I want to be the Diane Rehm of dinner parties. You know, I think it's the breadth of stuff that we cover on the show, which is everything, you know, literally everything in culture, from food to even history, stuff that you would talk about in the culture. It's not even necessarily the arts or anything. There seems to be enough breadth of it that there's an inexhaustible supply of stuff to talk about. I would, though, like to do that. I have an idea. Should I broach this? It's an idea for a show. Somebody's going to steal it.
It's just, you know, we're just having a conversation
here. Yeah, no one's listening, right? There's a show that I've always wanted to do called The News for Cats. It would be a podcast. I don't think public radio is going to air it. But it would be like very straight, almost kind of The Onion News kind of thing. But it would only be news that would be interesting to cats. I don't know where I figured this out, but
I don't know if I'd hold my breath on the National Endowment for the Arts funding for that, but
those
you
guys
never
love
know.
Cats.
Sure.
Are you kidding? But it would be things like, I don't know how, I set up a Google alert for cats, and it's astonishing what comes up. If you look on that news feed, it's like every single week there's some story somewhere in America about a crazy cat person who's been discovered harboring 10,000 cats in their house. So you could do the crazy cat person update. There are a million sports teams that are named after cats, wildcats, you know, lions, things like that. So you could do only sports.
Not in this town. Not in Pittsburgh.
No. Pittsburgh would be off the map.
Oh, well, you got the Panthers, though.
The Panthers.
You do have the Pitt Panthers.
That's right. So it would be 100% Panther coverage.
There you go.
Pittsburgh would love it.
Well, when are you going to write your screenplay based in Pittsburgh? Because you've had this training and you're from here.
Because between Michael Chabon, nobody knows how to pronounce that guy's name. Chabon, maybe? And the guy who did Perks of Being a Wallflower, Stephen Chbosky. They all have Ch in their name. That's already been done. When Perks of Being a Wallflower came out, I went to a press screening of it, and I gritted my teeth because that was the movie that I and literally every artistic-minded person in my high school dreamed of making one day. It is literally, like, the opening shot of that movie is backtracking through the Fort Pitt tunnels, mm-hmm. is a trip that me and my friends made probably every single day during the summers in Pittsburgh. So we did it already. Can we retroactively withdraw that movie from circulation?
Well, you could write a movie about trying to get around Pittsburgh and getting directions from people and not being able to find your way around. Describe what it's like when you come back here and it's been a while and you're trying to find your way around. And
I've more than ever realized how terrifying Pittsburgh must be to outsiders. I still remember how to get around to the places I used to go to all the time. But I was in town for a wedding this weekend, and it was out in South Park, which is an area I'm not that familiar with. And the bewildering maze of construction that is going on out there, whoever is providing those orange and white striped little paddles that they put on the side of the road is doing gangbuster business. You should get into that business. You'll make a ton of money. But it was really daunting. Without the advent of GPS and smartphones, I don't know how people ever got around in Pittsburgh. But I think you were referring specifically to the idea of giving directions based on landmarks that don't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's. I found myself doing that today. Like, actually, not today. It was when I first got into town. I was trying to give directions to somebody, and I told them to go past where an Isley's used to be. And they have never been to Pittsburgh, so they don't know what the hell I was talking about. But everybody does that. Why do you think that is?
I don't know, but that could be something to explore in your next movie. Maybe it'll be a documentary instead of a narrative.
The Roads of Pittsburgh.
You have the reporting experience. You know.
I can make it happen.
You are a renaissance man. Pittsburgh native Rico Galliano has been my guest. He hosts the Dinner Party Download, heard Friday nights at 9 on WESA. Rico Galliano, it's been a pleasure getting to sit and talk with you face-to-face. Thanks for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
It is an honor. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we will talk with our sports guy, Bob Dvorak, as he looks back at the life of NFL legendary running back Chuck Muncy on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.